it appears to be a very dangerous situation for journalists to report from the war zone in a way that the Pentagon does not like.
Here is a guy who has benefited from the defense contracts that have gone into the Iraq war, now being the man who is chosen to, in essence, become the governor general of Iraq.
This government says there's no money. But somehow when they go off into this economic, greedy adventure in Iraq, they can find $80 billion.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, April 14th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. Marines overran Iraqi loyalists staging a last stand today at Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, overrunning the last bastion of major Iraqi resistance and effectively bringing to an end the combat phase of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. According to the military, the presidential palace was seized and large numbers of U.S. troops were visible in the afternoon in central Tikrit. Iraqi police and U.S. troops began jointly patrolling the Iraqi capital of Baghdad today, stumbling over language difficulties, but determined to bring order after days of wholesale chaos. Navy Captain Frank Thorpe, a spokesperson for U.S. Central Command in Doha, Qatar, said U.S. troops reported sporadic fighting with small groups of fighters, he said, often foreign fighters, Syrians as well as from other countries. The Bush administration said today it will consider diplomatic, economic, and other steps against Syria because of concerns that Damascus is harboring fleeing Iraqi leaders and has tested chemical weapons. President Bush and his top officials would not say whether they are considering military action against Iraq's neighbor. Well, after two Arab news agencies, the Al Jazeera Network and Abu Dhabi Television, were bombed by U.S. forces last week, questions have risen over whether the U.S. military is deliberately targeting unembedded journalists. To get some analysis, Peace Watch spoke earlier today with noted media critic and founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, Norman Solomon, who organized two trips to Baghdad last year with U.S. Representative Nick Rahal and actor Sean Penn. We asked Solomon about his perspective on the recent attacks of media sites, including the Palestine Hotel, where 250 international journalists were stationed.
I think there's a pretty clear message from the Pentagon, and that is, if you play by our rules, your chances of being injured or killed are much less than if you go off by yourself. And they've even come up with this different language, embedded versus unilaterals, to signify who's a team player and who may not be a team player. So when we've had the Pentagon's forces killing journalists, there's been a kind of an ominous response from the Pentagon. Over at the Defense Department, Victoria Clark said, for instance, last week, news organizations eager to get their people unilaterally into Baghdad were saying it is not a safe place, you should not be there. And she uses the term unilaterally, I think, quite pointedly, because that's as opposed to the embedded ones who are under the wing of the U.S. troops.
Which basically, to me, seems to be, on the face of it, completely antithetical to what journalists are supposed to be doing if you're supposed to be reporting objectively, and yet you're traveling with one side, and you're reliant upon the military for your transportation, your food, your safety. How are you going to be reporting objectively? And how does this contrast to how journalists have covered wars throughout history, for example? Or let's just take it back as far as the first Gulf War.
Yeah, well, I think that this experiment has worked out pretty well from the Pentagon standpoint in terms of these so-called embedded journalists. In our book, we talk a lot about the way that the first Gulf War coverage was orchestrated in terms of the videos that were shown, the distance that journalists had from the actual fighting or the bombing for the most part. And some journalists kind of groused after the fact. I think it turned out to work out very well from a PR standpoint for the Pentagon because there was so much human interest coverage. You heard discussion about how trust was established. I would argue that the trust that should exist is not between the journalists and the troops they're covering, but between the journalists and the viewers, listeners, and readers. So you had this relationship where they were entwined, embedded, enmeshed with each other, and enormous humanizing of those who were invading, but very little humanizing of those who were being attacked. And you did not have hundreds and hundreds of American troops embedded with Iraqi families, embedded with those who had to hear the 2,000-pound bombs falling in their neighborhoods. And I think that this was both literally and figuratively very similar to the kind of coverage we got in the build-up to this war and then throughout the war, which, of course, is still continuing. We have a kind of a different meaning of terrorism as defined by the U.S. reporters, and I think it was quite notable that some of the coverage in the last few weeks has even used the word terrorism to describe attacks on U.S. invaders inside Iraq, of course, never using the term terrorism to describe cruise missiles that were terrifying, certainly for millions of people in Baghdad and Basra and elsewhere. The ways in which the Pentagon has laid down markers in terms of coverage of the war have certainly changed between the first Gulf War, which was much more at a distance, and this war. But underlying, I think, most profoundly, has been an enormous self-censorship within U.S. news media organizations. And it doesn't have to be this way to cover a war. As a matter of fact, good coverage would be quite the opposite. And to listen to the BBC News, for instance, and compare it with NPR radio in the United States, or to watch BBC television and to compare it to the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS in the United States, is really to see two very different versions of covering the war.
Mm. War is a danger zone, and how is a journalist expected to be able to cover this and at the same time have his or her own safety protected? And what are the foreign journalists doing that our journalists or the journalists from the U.S. are failing to do?
Well, I think one thing foreign journalists are tending to do is to report more independently. They're not as likely to be embedded, but more importantly, when they file a story, they realize that they're not supposed to tint the window on the world red, white, and blue. And the folks back home are editing in ways, in general, with some exceptions, that are much more open to an even-handed coverage of the war. I mean, when you look at a dying child, if you're a journalist, you convey what's going on there without making excuses for those who fired the missiles. You let the viewers and readers not only draw their own conclusions, but you provide a historical context that doesn't provide exoneration automatically to those who have fired the weapons. But if you look, for instance, at who has suffered from the U.S. attacks in Iraq, you find a very disturbing pattern. The Al Jazeera network, widely watched in the Arab world, has been met with enormous hostility in recent years from the U.S. government. Is it a coincidence that in Al Jazeera's experience in Kabul in Afghanistan in late 2001, the Pentagon bombed their bureau in the capital of Afghanistan? And now, just about a week ago, a U.S. missile hit the Al Jazeera office in Baghdad. I don't think that's a coincidence. I talked to Al Jazeera journalists who told me and confirmed that the Pentagon had been repeatedly informed of the exact coordinates of the Al Jazeera office in Baghdad. And you really, I think, need to look very closely at this pattern in which it appears to be a very dangerous situation for journalists to report from the war zone in a way that the Pentagon does not like.
Well, on April 9th, Vice President Dick Cheney, in remarks to the American Society of News Editors at the Fairmont Hotel in New Orleans, he's quoted as saying, quote, "The suggestion that we would somehow encourage deliberate attacks on journalists makes no sense at all. You'd have to be an idiot to believe that."
Yeah. Well, that is the conventional wisdom. The New York Times last Thursday editorialized, quote, "It is not surprising that Al Jazeera staff members lashed out angrily in a moment of great pain, but their suspicions were groundless." Well, that's the New York Times starting from the assumption that the United States government is incapable of targeting journalists. But you got to look at the facts otherwise, and you come to very different conclusions. For instance, the Iraqi TV offices in Baghdad were hit by a U.S. missile on March 25th of this year. There were human rights groups, there were journalists that condemned that attack. Cheney and Rumsfeld and the entire U.S. government not only acknowledged but bragged about the fact that Iraqi TV had been attacked by the Pentagon. What they say is that they've got a right to do that because it's a propaganda outlet. Well, you know, if we're going to say that it's okay to bomb propaganda outlets, then who's to say it's not appropriate to bomb Fox Television, which is certainly a propaganda outlet as well? As a matter of fact, the Geneva Conventions forbid targeting civilian installations, whether they're owned by a government or not, unless they're being used for military purposes, which was not the case with Iraqi TV.
Also on April 8th, three sites were hit, the Abu Dhabi TV, Al Jazeera, and the Palestine Hotel. The Palestine Hotel being a facility that is fairly widely known, I think, that housed journalists. Is it possible, in your opinion, that were these just coincidences, or in your suspicion that these journalists are being targeted, that you include them as well?
I think the attack on the Palestine Hotel was indicative of the fact that the Pentagon will attack civilians if they're seen to be in the way, and when in doubt, if it appears to be a good idea for military reasons or just out of impulse to attack, that's what's going to happen. And the killings at the Palestine Hotel, I think, were not premeditated, but at the same time were deliberate. And by that I mean that all the witnesses say there was no gunfire coming from the hotel. The tank that fired on the Palestine Hotel very carefully, deliberately, and painstakingly moved the turret to target the hotel and then fired. I do think the most suspicious attack is on Al Jazeera. In that case, my personal belief is it was intended, but in other cases, journalists are running some of the risks that Iraqi civilians have encountered in general. Journalists are not more or less important as human beings than anybody else.
What would the U.S. stand to gain by deliberately killing journalists? Surely, to do so, they would lose public support for the operation.
Well, in the case of Al Jazeera, it has been the enemy number one of Washington for years because it's seen as a hostile media outlet. It's widely seen by people in the Arab world. And to make the country unsafe for Al Jazeera journalists would be very valuable for the Pentagon. The Pentagon has denounced repeatedly Al Jazeera over a period of years now. And in fact, there was a move right after the attack on the Al Jazeera office in Baghdad by the editor-in-chief of the network to pull their people out of Baghdad. It's clear that the Pentagon got away with this before when the office in Kabul was bombed. And you can see from the U.S. media response that there's very little critical scrutiny of these attacks on Al Jazeera in the U.S. press. So why would they do it? I think because there's a perception that there's very little downside and a real upside in doing so.
Norman Solomon is founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. Well, the harsh reality of the fall of Baghdad last week echoed fear, anger, and pessimism around the Arab world. The sigh of relief at the collapse of the dictatorial regime of Saddam Hussein was short-lived, with Arabs both dismayed at the sight of looting in Iraq and scared of a possible attack on Syria. Today on Peace Watch, we'll check in with our reporters throughout the region to see how people feel about the recent events. We start with Ula Farahwati in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates.
Almost 80% of the population of Dubai is foreign. This, however, did not prevent people here from having almost a unified opinion when it comes to the easy fall of Baghdad and the acts of looting currently taking place all around Iraq. They believe that the ultimate aim of this war is to provide security to Israel. They also thought that those who rejoiced the occupation of Iraq were only a fraction of Iraqis who do not represent the Iraqi people. Hani Ahmad, a Palestinian writer based in Dubai, was very angry at the destruction of Iraq.
Those who are looting do not represent the Iraqi people. Those who looted, plundered, and rejoiced at the American troops' entry to Baghdad and helped the Americans destroy the statue of Saddam Hussein do not represent the residents of Baghdad, who number at least 5 million. These were several hundred lunatics. No sane person would actually welcome invaders who destroy a big part of their country.
The fact that the U.S. administration has started to threaten Syria strengthened the belief in the Arab world that the war on Iraq was the first phase of a comprehensive plan that aimed at the disarmament of all Middle Eastern states that are hostile to Israel. Walid Akawi is a Syrian businessman.
They control everything.
They are coming to control everything to service Israel, which is part of the U.S. The aim is to provide security to Israel, since Iraq will also be torn to pieces. These pieces will be based on ethnic affiliations, so that they can give legitimacy to the creation of Israel, which was based on ethnic beliefs.
Hussein is an Iranian taxi driver. He's worried that his country, which was stigmatized as part of the famous Axis of Evil, will be next in line.
They are using the same excuses they used to justify the war in Iraq to attack Syria. I don't really know what will happen next, and I know that Iran is next in line.
In Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, this is Ola Farawati for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
Turkish State Minister Ali Babagan, who is in Washington for the spring meeting of the IMF and World Bank, said that the Turkish economy has not been affected by the war. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister of Israel Sylvan Shalom arrived in Istanbul to discuss the consequences of the Iraq war with Turkish officials. As Ezgi Saratas reports, while meetings are going on among officials to discuss the aftermath of the war, the attitude of the Turkish people towards the war is less accepting.
Ankara, the capital of Turkey, is a city of civil servants. On a recent sunny afternoon, they are lined up in front of a kiosk where they can buy cheap bread from the government. Among them is Mehmet Yildirim.
War will affect our life economically. The government has already been searching for a reason to trim the civil servants. Even though positive things happen out there, they will affect us negatively.
Turkey's economy is dependent on two main sources. One of them is the tourist industry, and the other is the foreign aid packages that make Turkey a country dependent on the International Money Fund and the World Bank for its economic survival. The war in Iraq has impacted both of these sources, but people are still hopeful. Aysel is also a civil servant.
It is good that the war is coming to an end. If it had been longer, it would have been bad for our country. Tourists would not come to Turkey then. It is also good for the Iraqi people that the war is over. But I wish it had never happened. I'm against the war, and I think America was wrong to invade Iraq.
90% of the Turkish people have opposed the war since its beginning. This opposition had a major effect on the parliament, which rejected a multi-billion dollar aid package proposed by the United States in return for Turkey's support in the war. But although it never received permission to use Turkish soil to launch attacks, the U.S. gained a quick victory in Iraq, which has strengthened America's image as a superpower in the eyes of the Turkish people, whether they like it or not. Süleyman Binici is a lawyer in Ankara.
Bana göre
America has become much stronger since the war. It has proven that it is the single power for the whole world, and especially the Middle East.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Ezgi Saratas in Ankara, Turkey.
And finally, from Cairo, Egypt, Raphael Kraft reports.
The news were hard to believe in the streets of Cairo. Confusion and bitterness could be read on the people's faces when they heard Iraqis showed little resistance against U.S. forces entering Baghdad. Rumors and speculations grew, and many in Egypt strongly believed the Iraqi Republican Guard was preparing a counterattack. Yusri Nasrallah, one of Egypt's most noted filmmakers, watched the live footage of the Saddam Hussein statue falling down in the center of Baghdad.
My première réaction, c'est
My first reaction was to ask myself, what couldn't I see on this footage? Of course, it's nice to see the statue of a dictator falling, but there was this ridiculous symbol of putting the American flag on the statue and then replacing it by an Iraqi flag. I then began to feel cold in my back because it was not about joy anymore, but about symbols, and with symbols, there is no joy.
Mohamed Mossad, an intellectual working for an interfaith Arab-Israeli understanding website, is seeing the consequences of this crisis in Egypt. If demonstrations against the war in Iraq took place in Egypt, in which many people accused the government of siding with the United States, Mossad observes a re-legitimization of Hosni Mubarak and his regime. He believes Egyptians should act and not react.
This is the time to raise questions, not to offer answers. First of all, how to deal with the new world order, how to use the American invasion in Iraq for the benefit of Egypt, how to enhance democracy, how to realize that our government is not the thing that will defend us against the United States. The intellectuals here in Egypt, no one would raise a question against the government nowadays, and this is, for me, it's very, very strange.
Heba Ghazi, a 24-year-old journalist working for various newspapers in Cairo, is being optimistic. Although she condemns the American attack in Iraq, she believes the crisis in Iraq will generate a dynamic of change in her country.
It proved clearly to the society and to the world that the elite now in our country has nothing to say or to give. It gave people the idea that this elite must be changed. So we must try to find a solution. We must fight to have our democracy, not to stand and wait for America to come to give us our rights, as what she's saying, as what is America now? She's saying that she is coming to liberate Iraq or something like that. No, this proved that we must move now to liberate our country before other people ask us to come to liberate it.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft.
As controlled images and information continue to reign through corporate media, giving the viewer or listener a lesson in the romanticism of war, we turn to the reality and experience of KPFK's Jerry Quickly, who tells a story not often described by journalists on the realities of what he felt as the bombs began to drop over Baghdad in what has now become the American occupation of Iraq.
The morning the bombing started was quite far away initially when the bombs first started. It was about an hour and a half after the ultimatum passed, around 5:32 in the morning, Baghdad time. You know, the sun was still nowhere to be seen. It was still dark, and you could hear, I first heard a jet engine and then what sounded like a distant boom. And the fact I heard a jet engine was a clear indication there was going to be a real, that the war was afoot, because there was a complete absence of sound and the sky in Iraq. You know, there were no planes, no jets, no prop planes, no helicopters, no nothing. And that was the first time I ever heard an airplane when I was in Baghdad. Was the morning the war started. And then the booms got louder, and they're very concussive. They kind of bend the air. You know, it's not something that is exclusively auditory. It's very tactile. And some of the booms were very, very close. There was a couple of missiles that were dropped in the city center, very near the Palestine Hotel, within about a kilometer. But the outlying area was bombed most heavily that first day. And then and there was a lot of anti-aircraft fire. And after the first boom, the air raid siren started up. It was a very, very chilling siren when you know that, in fact, the war has just started.
In the midst of this bombing, you did get a chance to speak to the human shields right before it?
Yeah, I had spoken to the human shields very extensively in Amman, Jordan, before transferring out and, you know, getting into Baghdad. I also met with many of the shields when I was in Baghdad and went to many of the sites where they were stationed. The shields, there were many shields that were still arriving within the last couple of days before the war. A group of 48 from South Africa, a fireman that I met from Barcelona, who was there to try to provide some training and expertise to the Iraqi firefighters for the pending, you know, firestorms that were going to be happening. Many, many different human shields at many, many different sites, and they were all deeply committed to the welfare of the people of Iraq. They weren't casting their lot with Saddam. They were casting their lot with the Iraqi people. You know, the effects of the bombing were, you know, just horrific on the Iraqi people and what was going on. There were, you know, there were bombed out bridges. There were bombed out cars and buses. There were untended bodies in the road. There were bombed out cars and buses. There were immolated corpses in these cars and buses. The smell was in the air was horrific. There were these rotting camel carcasses. And these are large animals. They stand 7 feet high, 6-7 feet high, 8 feet high at the shoulder. They're massive. Petrol stations were bombed out. These were places that I had stopped on the way in, on the drive into Baghdad when I was inbound. And they were very vibrant, active places. You know, they had water cellars there. And they're like, in, you know, the Iraqi version of a truck stop. And, you know, that just the brief, very brief flirtation transit situation I was in gave me a just a tiny little glimpse of what it's, you know, of what it is to live under that kind of threat where you're at one station. And, you know, I all of a sudden I got like my head, like got hit in the head and the car and I was and it really hurt. And I was like, what the hell is that? And the car is like kind of rocking. And I'm like, why is the car rocking? And why does my head hurt? You know, it finally dawned on me that what had happened was the station had been rebombed and the shockwave from the bomb hit before the sound did very immediately. And you don't even hear the sound in a sense. It just lifted the car and shook the car, pushed it a few feet. And the door jamb of the car smacked me in the head. But you don't even process this when it's going on. It's just like all of a sudden you're hit in the head. It was terrifying. And most particularly because, you know, I just thought it was going to be, you know, that was the opening part of the bombing and we're going to be hit by some missile or some bomb or something. So I was very surprised that I survived the deportation. But that being said, you know, the entire country is a war zone. The experience that I had is really extremely minimal compared to what is going on right now to the Iraqi people. You know, I had this brief little experience that was, you know, quite scary and horrific, but it's nothing compared to what the people of Iraq are going through right now. They're having these people literally having hell poured on their heads on a daily and nightly basis. And it's not something that you can even really imagine. I've gone through it and I can't imagine it.
You know, one of the things that always happens, I know whenever I've gone any place around the world, and especially in the third world, one of the first things that hits you is sort of like the horror that America puts people through in the world. You really come back. I did always came back just hating this place just a little bit more, and I can only imagine what it's, you know, what it's done to you in terms of your outlook around this.
I think what was most upsetting to me about it, certainly initially, was when the bombs first started falling in Baghdad, and I had this overwhelming sense of helplessness and the sense of, it wasn't even anger or frustration, but I had never been that hopeless before in my life, that in spite of all the efforts of all these millions of people all over the world, that the war was still happening, was still going to go on, and there were all these people that were going to be murdered. And out of all the hundreds of people that I met throughout the country, all the people I met in Iraq, I didn't know which of them were going to survive and which of them weren't going to survive. And it was, you know, I'd never been in a circumstance like that, and I remained deeply concerned about the people I've met in Iraq.
What happened to you then? You ended up getting deported. What was the context of that? What happened?
Well, it's a very bureaucratic society. The Office of Residency was closed on the 17th and never reopened. You have to go to the Office of Residency to get extensions of the visa. I had already gotten one extension. It was no big deal. And they were supposed to grant the others and no big deal. But the Office of Residency closed in anticipation of the war. And so the Iraqi official was supposed to secure my visa extension, waited too long, didn't get it. So they say, okay, now you have to go. But I didn't really think much of it because there are other people there with expired visas, a guy next door to me, another journalist in the room next to me at the Palestine. Had his visa expired 3 days earlier. Mine hadn't even expired yet. And I thought once the war started, all this visa crap will go away. But that wasn't the case at all. And I had to kind of bargain with them to not expel me during the first afternoon of the war because it would have meant traveling the highway mostly at night with a great number of American aircraft out there poaching around looking for targets or zeroing in on targets, and I didn't want to be driving in a government vehicle at that time, being a passenger in a government vehicle at that time. So I eventually convinced them through begging, pleading, bribing, and everything else to allow me to be deported the following day, earlier in the day, so as little of the trip as possible would be at night. And then later, and then there was all these delays and everything, and later that afternoon I was finally deported.
That was KPFK's Jerry Quickly, who was interviewed by Michael Slate regarding his recent assignment in Iraq. The segment was produced by Christine Blasdale and edited by Fidel Rodriguez for Peace Watch. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.